You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
With us this week, whether you're listening live or you catch us on the podcast, we thank you so much for your time and attention. And we want to say a special thank you to the hosts and the guests that sat in for us last week. A special shout out to host Tom Swearingen, award-winning poet, and his guest, cowboy poet Mark Munzer. It was a great show. We watched it from our hotel room in Tucson.
That was good.
We were, where were we last week?
That's right. We were in Tucson. Tucson, Arizona, for the Tucson Festival of Books.
Yes. And we started on Friday in Tombstone, where we caught up with some author friends for a one-day Tombstone Festival. And then we were all weekend, in Tucson. Did you have fun?
We did.
Yeah. Did we meet some people?
We met some people we know, some friends, and made some new friends.
And we made some new friends, and we hope that some of them will join us on the show come this summer and fall. So Tucson Festival of Books and Tombstone Book Festival both were just terrific. And we are delighted to be back live, and our special guest is standing by. And who do we have tonight?
Candace Simar.
And there Hi, Candace. Candace, where are you joining us from?
From Pequot Lakes, Minnesota.
Minnesota. I was born in Minneapolis, but I was only there 6 months. So I can't claim anything other than born there.
They didn't want you or what?
Well, we are delighted to have you with us. Let's see. You know, one of the fun things, Jim, was Candace signed on to join us, and we got to read her book before it became available. Yes. In fact, it is so not yet ready that we don't have a book cover to show you tonight. But the title of the book is Sister Lumberjack. And we're excited. Candace, you want to tell us a little something about the book before we get more started? Jim's going to introduce you in a minute, but tell us a little something about the book.
Sister Lumberjack is about a young lumberjack with bottle fever, a grieving widow with a mortgage, and a very unusual nun selling hospital tickets. And their lives intersect at Starkweather Timber, a haywire logging camp where everything goes wrong.
Lots of obstacles. So, Jim, tell us a little something about Candace.
Okay, we have a little intro. Candace Simar is a Minnesota writer who loves history and Scandinavian heritage. She combines both into hysterical fiction. She is grateful for a Spur Award, Will Rogers Gold Medallion, a Willow Award, Laura Awards, Peacemaker Awards from Western Fictioneers, and Midwest Book Awards. She writes a Roundup magazine column called Best Writing Tips.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. We feel so honored to have you with us tonight. Such a multi-award winner. Let's see. We were talking about the book not being available yet, but it is available to pre-order.
Yes.
And when do you expect it will be available for shipping?
Orders from my website will go out this weekend. But officially, it doesn't come out until later in the month.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't have copies.
Yeah.
Very good.
That's just has to be, I don't know, when you're waiting for a book to launch, Candace, because you've launched a few, what does that feel like? What goes on each day as you're counting down to launch day?
You know, putting a book out for people to read is like putting your baby in a beauty contest. You know, in your eyes, it's beautiful, but maybe not to everyone else's eyes. So there's always a little bit of that reality check.
Sure. That's totally understandable. Do you want, I think, should we go ahead and ask her a little bit about her writing background?
Yeah, her background. Yeah.
Yeah.
When did you first start writing?
How did I start writing?
I
was a nurse in my working years, and in my mid-40s, I got the writing bug. And the only writers I knew were poets. And so I joined a poetry group. Not because I really liked poetry or wanted to write poetry, but they were the only writers that I knew. And I learned so very much from the poets. And I'm so grateful I got my start with them. A poet really sees the world with different eyes and notices things that other people don't. And it was such good training for me. I have written poetry, and I even wrote a poetry book, but I just am so grateful to have learned so much from the poets.
Yeah. You attended the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Yes.
That's such a prestigious program. You want to just talk a little bit about that workshop and how maybe it influenced you or helped you along the way?
The Iowa Summer Writing Festivals are, I think, about a dozen workshops that are concurrent at the same time on the University of Iowa campus. And it goes on most of the summer. And I had Googled historical fiction workshops, and only one came up, and that was in Iowa with Diana Osana, who turned out to be Larry McMurtry's writing partner. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know the connection, you know, I just kind of went there blind, and it was so wonderful. Diana was a great teacher and a great writer, and she shared a lot of tips from Larry's writing style. And they were both so very generous to me. I'm appreciative. They both blurbed my books, my early books, and gave constructive feedback, which I needed very badly. So it was good.
You have won a number of awards, and congratulations on each one of those. Do you have any kind of a memory or a recollection of how you were notified? Maybe not necessarily the first one, but maybe it's the first one. How were you notified, and how did that feel?
Well, I went to my first Western Writers of America convention in 2011. It was in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is drivable from Minnesota. And so I went there, didn't know a soul, and ended up sitting at the banquet next to a Spur Award winner. And I was just so awed that this kid, he was just a young guy, could win such an award. And I thought, it will never happen to me. And the next year I entered a book, and wouldn't you know, I won. So, you know, what did they say about success is mainly showing up?
Showing up.
And I work really hard on my research and writing, and I'm just so thrilled that it has been recognized. You know, I look pretty good on paper. That's what I tell my husband. But every day when you sit down to write, you have to decide if you're going to be a writer again.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. What is it about historical fiction of all genres that you could choose to write in? What is it about historical fiction that really calls you?
You know, I wish I could explain it. It's something I've loved since I was a little kid. I love the history, and I really like the frontier stories. And when I was a young woman, there were lots of frontier series out and very popular. But now it's not so much that. in certain circles, it's more crime and thrillers. But I just love the historical frontier stories. Mm-hmm. So it works better for me if I write what I love.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of given stories to write, and we have to write what we're given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you have it. I know I've been asking all the questions.
You have?
Yes, I have.
Well, let's talk about Six-Year Lumberjack for a moment.
Okay.
What kind of inspired you to write that one?
You know, I was writing Abercrombie Trail, which was my very first novel. And Solveig was a minor character. She was loosely based on a great-grandmother of mine who came to America from Norway as an indentured servant. She thought it was a pretty good deal. She had to work 5 years, but she had her passage over. She had a place to stay. She had a wage, and she had a chance to learn the language. And that's not a bad deal for a young woman coming alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I always admired that about her. Not that I ever knew her, but so I decided to put her in Abercrombie Trail as one of the characters. And she was such a strong character that she kept taking over the book. She was stronger than my main character, which if you're a writer, you know that cannot happen. I fought her back and fought her back because she wanted to take over. And I never put her in the series again. But now in her widowhood, she can take center stage and she can do what she wants. And I let her do it. I don't fight her anymore.
I think
we wonder sometimes, you know, whether, you know, those characters do things you don't kind of expect them to.
So. That's a good sign. When the characters take off on their own, that's a very good sign, I think.
So how did she feel when you were just saying, no, 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 go away? Did she just keep talking to you, or she come in your dreams and, you know, she say, okay, then give me a book of my own?
Well, she kept intruding into the scenes.
She did.
You know, I hadn't planned for her to be anywhere. And then all of a sudden, here she was trying to take over again.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
So
now she can.
So now she can. Now she can. There are some themes that, you know, it was really fun at the festival, Tucson Festival of Books. We sat in on a romance writers panel, and there were 12 of them. And they talked about tropes and what they really were talking about, the things they liked to write about the most, the themes that just they kept coming back to. And I thought, you know, we don't use the word tropes in other genres, I don't think, right?
I've never heard it used in historical fiction.
Yeah. But I feel as I was reading this book, and again, we are readers, and I was engaged in this book from the very beginning. I was feeling Solveig's pain and almost sort of terror over being a widow and then knowing that she just had to press forward. But there are some themes that I felt that kind of run through the book. Do you want to touch on or two?
When I spoke with Bobby Jean the other day in prep for this interview, she said, do you know there are themes of redemption in your book? And I kind of chuckled because, yes, I do know. that was one of the things I wanted to write about, was that even if you're too old, you have lots of trouble in your life, if you're a young man with struggles, if you feel like you're in a vocation that maybe doesn't fit you, there's always hope for something better to come around.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that came through, Bobby Jean, because that's something I really believe in.
Yes. And you don't really want to do spoiler alerts, but there are a couple of characters where you kind of wonder as a reader, like, or even like, why is this character still in this book? She could have, you know, a log, a tree could have come down. She, yes. You know, any number of things could happen. But there's a reason. And then we discover, of course, that redemption is, you know, just around the corner.
One thing I learned in my research, the logging camps had huge bunkhouses where about 120 men slept in one big shed, basically. And the bunks were triple layered and two men to a bunk. So there were six men in very close quarters. And someone made the comment that you learn to appreciate the ones that shut their mouths. And I thought, you know, isn't that the truth? You get so many people together, it can be very wearing to hear people talk about the same things over and over.
Sure.
Had the feeling that I would not have liked sleeping in that bunkhouse.
Oh, and there's a line, was it the doctor? There's a line that says, a lumberjack never sleeps alone.
Right.
And it would be very easy to think of that different ways. But what did that mean, the lumberjack never sleeps alone?
That means that the bunkhouses were called bedbug hotels, and there were lots of lice. So, yes, they never slept alone.
Actually, you know, flipping back through the pages after having read it, there were so many great, I was writing down quotes, there were so many wonderful, wonderful, you're just a wonderful writer.
Thank you very much.
You suppose those guys ever got used to that?
I guess if that's your conditions, the smells, and, you know, Candace, we're right there. You don't spare any detail. You can do it in a small number of words, but we can smell, we can taste, we can feel that cold, almost frostbite. There were times reading the book where I had to go grab another blanket.
Well, I've grown up in cold weather. I know what it is.
And of course it's winter, 1893.
Yes.
And the naive person that I was never thought that logging is a winter profession. I didn't know. So I found that so interesting. And then that winter landscape is really another character in the book.
Yes, it was brutal. My grandfather, as a young immigrant from Denmark, worked in a logging camp like that. And I always thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. Do you have a question? Otherwise, we can go to a quick. But I'm sure you have something you'd like.
No, let's go right to the break.
Okay. We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we are going to get more into this wonderful book, Sister Lumberjack. Here is one of the places you can find it. We'll be right back.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer, special guest, Candace Simar. We were just talking about Candace and her new book,
Sister Lumberjack. Yes.
And we have a little thought here. We get the Benedict Order.
Benedictine rule
is important
in this book. Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of where Sister Lumberjack kind of comes from and how this all plays into the story?
Well, that was one of the things in my research that fascinated me and led me to write this book. I discovered that there were Benedictine nuns who built all the hospitals in northern Minnesota. They built them for the miners and the lumberjacks to provide health care because there was none before. And these sisters just did it very quietly. They didn't really have a medical background, but they just went in and did the best they could, and the hospitals are still standing. It's very fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And so I discovered this one nun. Her name in real life was Sister Amata, and she was a large woman, over 6 feet tall, very big, very large, very muscular. They would call on her to haul the barrels of salt pork, and they would, you know, she carried the heavy lifting. She killed the rats. She was the person they turned to. And they came up with this program where she would go from logging camp to logging camp, selling hospital tickets for $1. And if a lumberjack was hurt and had a $1 ticket, he had free health care in the hospitals that they had built. And any money left over would be used to build more hospitals closer to where the men were working. And very interesting, like an insurance program.
That is what I was going to say. It sounds like maybe one of the first very forms of a health program, of health insurance.
It would be one of them.
Yeah.
And their motto was, if all give a little, everyone will benefit.
Mm-hmm. And I think, as I recall in the book, they figure out, you know, there's 30,000
yes.
lumberjacks working in that winter of 1893.
Yes.
And so even if, you know, if each one gave a dollar, and then they did give it, but it was actually held back from their
wages.
And it was very interesting because she, Sister Lumberjack, goes, like you said, she leaves Duluth and she goes all around to these camps. And so through her, we get to experience a little bit of what that's like. And she's a saleswoman. I mean, she has to get permission. The owner of the camp has to kind of agree because they will pay her before she leaves on what these, you know, what the jacks commit to. And so they're not going to wait till the end of the season to get their money, which makes sense because they need the money to do what they need to do as, you know, accidents may happen. So she's also like, no, I get the money now.
She needed it.
But they really respect her with the exception of our one camp owner. That was also to me interesting that no matter where she went, she was just automatically respected by the lumberjacks and by the owners.
She was very much into justice.
Uh-huh.
You know, if she saw an injustice, she felt it was her duty to at least try to remedy it. And of course, that's according to the rule of Saint Benedict, which was their guiding along with scriptures. And rule of Benedict is basically scriptures. But in it, it gives day-to-day guidelines how to live your life.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad you enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah.
She's not a small person.
No.
She probably could whip half those lumberjacks.
That's probably partly, you know, you can imagine her coming into camp tall in, you know, in her habit and all. And
on snowshoes.
25 years old. She also is a bit of a, I don't want to say klutz exactly, but we have some incidences that could almost be dire, but everything works out. And then she just can't stop laughing.
She can't stop laughing. she has this sense of humor that gets her through, and it's frowned upon by a lot of her sisters.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think of her like a big golden retriever. I thought of that very often when I was writing her character. She's friendly and outgoing and can break things, get in the way, you know.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Solve a little bit.
Oh yeah, Solve.
What gets you to the mining camp?
Logging camp. We get cowboys, miners, and loggers.
Well, mining last week.
The jobs for older women were non-existent. You know, maybe they could get a job where, you know, a saloon, maybe washing dishes or cleaning. But the problem with that is even if she was paid for doing the work, she would have to pay for room and board somewhere. So she would not be able to save any money. The only hope of having a job with enough pay to pay off her mortgage and rescue her farm on the prairie was to be a cook. She knew how to cook. And A cook was paid very well, but a lot of responsibility. She had to cook for 120 hungry men three meals a day without any conveniences, nothing frozen, nothing from the bakery. You know, they would bake 22 loaves of bread a day. They would have 20 pies a day, just constantly cooking and cleaning up. Mm-hmm. But she made good money doing that. And so she was able to meet some of her goals. But what a challenge for an older woman, you know. I got tired just reading about it sometimes.
Her bunions
ached, yes.
She's busy from, you know, the moment she's up and her head hits the bed and she's out. And she really misses those times on the farm, where you would imagine life on the farm is also pretty, you know, doesn't stop. Chores are just continuous. But she would recognize that at the farm, in her farm life, she had moments where she could choose to sit down. She could read for a little, you know, she could manage her time in a way that she could not do with this job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was just driven, and then she had to manage people who are difficult employees. And if anyone's been in management, you know exactly what I mean. I was a manager for many years, and that's sometimes the hardest part of the job, is keeping people working.
Yeah. You give us so much great detail. So for instance, and I asked you if you might be able to share this. So the night before she leaves, she's going to leave her farm and she's going to go head out and try to find a position in a logging camp as a cook or something. Cook. She packs.
She packs her trunk, and this is what she packed.
What does she take?
She packed aprons, everyday dresses, handkerchiefs, petticoats, nightgowns, mittens, rubber overshoes, her warmest shawls, sweaters, both sets of underwear. She tucked bars of homemade soap into the toes of her everyday shoes. She added socks, sheets, and blankets, and a butcher knife from the kitchen, and a set of candles. She took the box of matches. Then she packed her chamber pot wrapped in a braided rug. A woman her age needed comforts. And then at the last minute, she took her three favorite hens and put them in a crate and took them on the train with her to the logging camp.
Mm-hmm. And she took Queenie.
And her cat. Yes,
I forgot about Queenie. Well, Queenie does it. Queenie works. Yeah, Queenie, you know, she goes to work right away. And I thought it was so brilliant that she took the chickens, because, of course, they produce eggs.
And, you know, most farm women look to their chickens as a bank account. You know, the farm women often kept the egg money, and you could always trade an egg for something. If you got hard up and if things were really bad, you could eat one.
Right. Yeah.
So
she almost thought that might happen.
Right.
But that gets resolved another way. But yeah.
So I think book clubs will like this book.
Yes.
It deals with widowhood, aging, raising adult children, which is not easy. Grandchildren, starting over when you don't feel you can, financial problems. It has a young man with an addiction and a real hard time getting settled in America, mm-hmm. People being exploited. And then you have the sisters trying to help them all. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to have a lot of themes to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I agree. You know, you talk about the logging business itself a little bit. It sounds like that was, we know it was cold and the conditions were hard, but was that a little bit dangerous work? You really had to know what you were doing?
Different jobs, yeah.
It was very dangerous, and there was a hierarchy in the camp. The highest paid person there would be the top loader, and he stood on top of the logs and secured them on the big sleigh that took the logs to the river. The cook was almost as much was paid almost as much as the top loader. But there were skitters and there were road monkeys. There were flunkies. There were, they had someone called a dentist who filed all the saws at night. And, you know, you think of a saw with all the jagged teeth on it. So everyone called him the dentist.
Yeah, it's very that was very clever. Yeah.
And they, had their own blacksmith and their own woodworking person. There was a person there who built all the sleds. And, of course, all the chairs and everything they used was built from logs there.
And you have teams. You have people who work the horse. Yes. The sleds are pulled by horses, but we did have oxen. Were there some oxen? Yeah.
And well, this camp was so poorly run that they were still using oxen.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, they did have some horses. But
yeah. Now, there was a guy, there was a job. Was he the top? Was there somebody that was like the boss? He had a good name. He's like the boss. He was. He would announce when it was time to blow gray wheels for you.
He was the bull of the woods.
Bull of the woods. That's
and
it.
He was like the foreman. The men called him the push because he's always pushing them. There was also a bull cook, and he was usually an old retired stove up lumberjack that the owner gave him a job basically out of pity to keep him housed. But he was up four times a night firing the stoves. He had to be up shoveling paths to the outhouses and the cook shack in the morning. And he just worked himself to death. So I never could understand why that was a easy job for an older person. But that was one of them.
There are some fun, you describe squirrel whiskey, and I thought that was, I don't know if you would remember what you wrote about squirrel whiskey, term I was not familiar with, of course.
I was not familiar either, and when I do my research, if I come across something quirky and unusual and interesting, I write it on a list, a legal pad. And then as I write my book, I thread those things in because I figure if I'm interested, there will be readers interested. Yeah. But I found this place where the men were offered squirrel whiskey. It wouldn't make them fly, but they'd jump around a little. And that was what they put the knockout drops in to rob them of their wages. Mm-hmm. And I think that happened in many of the industries at the time. So, but I thought that was good. It doesn't make you fly, but you'll jump around a little bit.
And of course, Sister Lucy, who's back in Duluth, I love this statement she makes: "The road to eternal life is paved with obstacles." That just sums up.
I think that's directly from the Rule of Benedict.
Ah, okay. Well, Sister Lou, well, that would make sense.
Yes.
We should probably take another break. Okay. And we'll have a word from our sponsor, Out West Shop. And when we come back, we'll be talking more with Candace. Stay tuned.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back. Rendezvous with the Writer. Special guest, Candace Simar. You know, I got to thinking, you know, during the break, you know, there might be some folks out there that might want to get on the show. How would they do that?
We could ask Candace. She got on the show. It's really, we love to hear from you. If you're a writer, poet, songwriter, publicist, literary agent, publisher, you are deeply entrenched in the written word. We would love to hear from you, and it's very simple to get started. Just email me at Bobby Jean Bell. That's Bobby with an I. It's all together, Bobby Jean Bell at gmail.com. And in the subject line, just say something like, I'm a writer, I'm an author, how do I get on the show? Something like that. And I think, Candace, I responded to you pretty quickly, didn't I?
Yes, you did. Very quickly.
I do my best to really get back to you as quickly as I can. And then we just kind of open some conversation about what you're doing, what you're writing, what you've got going. And we kind of look at our calendar and figure out a time that'll work. So we're pretty easy, you think, Candace, to work with? You can give us a little testimony.
So far, so good.
Put you right on the spot. This is unscripted, obviously.
Thing that I didn't know was that frontier fiction is part of the Western genre now. Did you recognize that?
No.
I was surprised when a friend of mine said, you need to join the Western Writers of America. And I said, I don't write Westerns. And I found out that any frontier fiction is considered part of the Western genre now.
Yeah. When you go to the Western Writers of America website, for instance, or follow on the Facebook page, it's just so interesting. You read all the categories for Spur Awards and such. We had the opportunity to talk very briefly to author C.J. Box after a panel. And so we just had a couple of moments. But I said to him, you know, I really thank you for writing what you write.
Yes.
And he said, well, it's contemporary Western fiction. And I said, that's what so many people don't, you know, they put us in boxes. It happens with Western music, too. You kind of put us in boxes that are wide open,
right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So, so I think it feels to me like the genre, the idea or the definition of, well, what's a Western just continues to also be very lively discussion.
My first book, Abercrombie Trail, was about the U.S. Dakota War of 1862. Happened during the Civil War. But it was one of the largest Indian wars in U.S. history that happened in Little Minnesota, which was the northwest corner of the Union at the time, and very low population. It didn't get a lot of attention because it happened after Shiloh and before Antietam.
Right.
And that fascinated me. I had found out that my great-grandfather drove the stagecoach across Minnesota to Fort Abercrombie in Dakota Territory, right at the end of the Civil War. So I used that idea of a stagecoach driver, and I moved it up a little so he was there for the Indian War.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that you were sharing that you thought your family would be so interested in this detail that you had learned about your family history. And what was the response when you presented this interesting fact to your family?
They didn't care about their great-great-grandfather, the U.S. Dakota War, or anything about Minnesota history.
But your son said.
I was ranting about our need to know our history, which I'm passionate about. We stand on our history. We are our history.
Yeah.
And our son said, well, if you care, why don't you write a book? And so I took up the challenge, and I'm stubborn enough that I wouldn't back down. But I had to learn how to write novels. It took me 9 years to get that first novel published.
Yeah.
Learned a lot, but I love the research. And just to imagine what people live through, the movie goes on in my head all the time. It's mm-hmm. great.
Mm-hmm. You write from several points of view because there are several major characters that we follow. How did you determine their individual voices?
I wanted Solveig because she was from the first book, and I thought she had an interesting story in her widowhood. And then I was very interested in Sister Lumberjack, who was a historical figure. I don't use her real name at the sisters' request. They asked that I not use her real name. And then I had written about 100 pages, I think, or more, on just the two women's point of view. And my mentor said to me, you can't have a book about a lumber camp without a lumberjack's point of view. because you won't get the whole story. And so I had to start over and rework it and build my character loosely based on my grandfather. Very loosely based.
We were talking about research, and did you have to do a lot of research?
Yes. It's easier now than it used to be because you can Google everything, and it's possible to go into the state historical societies and just read the documents online without even traveling. I grew up hearing family stories, which I tucked into the book and to my characters in odd places. And my husband is a forester, worked for Department of Natural Resources in Minnesota for 40 years. So he was kind of my expert that I turned to for details about the logging. Plus, I read all of his logging books. He has a whole shelf of them and used them for research. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Are you an outliner or a pantser or some combination?
I'm a combination. I start out as a pantser for sure. I'm just writing the story. But in later years, I've been more interested in structure, which I was not interested in when I first started. And I have a book. There is a book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel, where it's based on the film industry's beats, where you have the structural points at certain percentage of your book. And so I've learned to write my book and then lay the Save the Cat Writes a Novel over it and then see if I'm meeting those points. And so if I'm way off on percentage, then I have to cut here in one place or add to another place to make it work out. And I find that I have a much stronger work doing that.
That's really interesting.
It is. You'll have to try reading
really
that book.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yes.
I know you have a question.
You have a structured program on when you write? Early in the morning, late at night, or whenever you get a moment?
I usually spend my mornings reading and writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you spend time doing some reading for pleasure? And if so, have you read something recently that we'd want to know about?
Well, you mentioned C.J. Box, and I'm right in the middle of Three Inch Teeth.
So
which is a very good book. And my husband and I love Longmire.
Yes, we do
so
too.
So we listen to Longmire audibles when we're on the road.
Yes. He is such a great narrator. Does the voice.
It's wonderful.
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Yes. What's the best literary investment you've ever made in your career? Best investment, not necessarily literary. I'm sorry. Best investment you've made in your literary career.
I've been to lots of writing workshops, and I went to two master novel classes in Taos, New Mexico, when they were having their writing conferences with the University of New Mexico. And that was just heavenly. To be one of six people going through your whole novel with five other novelists and a master level professor.
Wow.
That was life changing for me. I went to two of them and I've been to lots and lots of writing workshops where I can go. And a few years ago, I couldn't find a writing workshop I wanted to go to. Lots of them are for beginners, which is fine. You can always learn something no matter what level you're at. But I was looking for a master level class and there was fewer and fewer and fewer. And so I had this bright idea that a bunch of my friends, writer friends, could rent a retreat house and hire a professor and have our own.
And have your own.
And we've been doing that for 7 years now.
Wow.
It's private, you know, if you have it open to the public, you have to become incorporated and all that. We don't want that. Yeah. It's just private, 12 friends getting together.
How fun.
And that has been just wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Do you ever deal with writer's block?
I really can't say I do. I deal with a lot of laziness, if that counts.
I have heard that before, yes. Yes. Where I'm just looking at time, Candace, I can't believe how fast this has gone. We want to make sure that everybody knows all those important things, where they can find you, website, social media, all of that. Can you share that with us?
Yes, www.CandaceSymar.com. Candace Symar, author on Facebook and on Instagram. I used to do Twitter and I lost it, and I've never been able to find it again. So I don't know what happened there, but I do check my Facebook and.
And what are you working on? What are you working on next?
Well, I had, I think, five great uncles who homesteaded on the North Dakota prairie as young men prior to World War I. And they went out together. That was their way to make a lot of money, you know, get a homestead. And so I'm writing about homesteaders in North Dakota. And when my characters speak, my great uncles open their mouths. And I'm having a great time with it.
Oh, that's great.
That's good.
Speaking of, Jim, you have a couple quotes.
Quotes.
Have a couple quotes. I'm just looking at our time. I think you can use them all.
Get them all in. Well, this one was one of our favorite characters, Solve. There's a quote from her, and she thinks, "Heartache brought a stumble to her steps as she walked across the yard. This farm was her life. Her life ended with Rasmus' death, or at least began its ending. Something happened when a woman lost her man, a loss of place in the family and community, a loss of respect." A little philosophy there.
True enough.
Move on to Aunt Sister Lumberjack. Gratitude flooded her heart, and a burst of joy sprouted up like a wellspring. It turned into a giggle, and then a chortle, and then a full-out guffaw. She was Sister Lumberjack, the 6-foot penguin on snowshoes. Yeah, that's great.
That's so great.
Thank you.
And then you had another one.
I always look for a quote outside what the writer has done. And I thought this fit, kind of fit in, you know? A question as opposed to a quote. If the great lumberjack, Paul Bunyan, of folklore fame was here today, would he have a story to tell?
Oh, Candace, this has been such fun. And next week, a good friend, I believe, of yours, mutual friend, another author who is returning to be with us is Miss Jean Cooney. This was the book the last time she was on with us. It's Murder, Don't You Know? And she has a new book coming out. And just like your book, we do not have the actual copy of it yet. We have the PDF, so we'll be prepared. But I don't have anything to hold up except, again, I attempted to blow up the cover of the book, and it's called It's Murder, You Betcha. A quirky murder mystery with recipes. So join us next week with returning guest Jean Cooney, and we're really looking forward to having her on with us. And we want to thank the Hot Texas Swing Band for providing the music that opens and closes the show. And to all of you that are watching or listening, and remember, you can catch this podcast, it's episode 77, on all your favorite streaming platforms. I'll be getting it up there tonight. And just search Rendezvous with a Writer. And thank you to Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio. And
we want to thank Candace.
Well, of course, we'll thank Miss Candace again. Yes.
And thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
We hope you had a good time, Candace. Thank you.
And it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing and we'll keep reading. See you next week. Bye.